You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, students and faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Superior protested after 25 programs were cut. Now, emails from the school's lawyers showed that those administrators didn't seek input or guidance from staff leading up to that decision. We'll learn more coming up. Right now, the number of criminal offenders that Wisconsin monitors with GPS devices has roughly doubled over the last 5 years. But the devices come with their share of technical issues. A lost signal or a dead battery can trigger police alerts and lead to more jail time. In a new series called Losing Track, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looks into what the program is costing the state and how it affects people trying to reintegrate into society. Dee Hall is the co-founder and managing editor for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, and Riley Vetterkind was a reporter with the center. They talked to Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson last week.
Dee, let's start with who's wearing these GPS tracking devices, or ankle bracelets as they're known. What sort of convictions can require that someone wear a tracking device after incarceration?
So most of these would be sex offenders, and some of these offenders have actually completed their sentences, including any probation or parole, and they are on what's called lifetime monitoring. And then there are some other folks who are on for other reasons, but that would be the vast majority of the 1,258 or so offenders who were on monitoring as of last month.
And Riley, the GPS tracking devices come with a lot of rules for offenders that wear them. And you found that oftentimes violations of those rules aren't necessarily the person's fault. What are some of the things that can go wrong with these trackers?
So from what offenders have told me, a lot of times they'll end up being told by corrections officials that they're in places where they're not located. Some really extreme cases that I've been told, I haven't been able to independently confirm, have been satellite points that are as far as Ontario, Canada, for some offenders in northern Wisconsin. But the more typical case is, being too close to a public park or being too close to another zone off limits, like a public library, for instance, in the case of one offender, where maybe they're just driving past, going about their business, and then the police show up at their door an hour later when they get back home.
And so those are instances where they are either somewhere, maybe briefly, where they're technically not supposed to be, or the information is wrong saying where they are. But then, Riley, you looked at the month of May 2017 as a snapshot of the program, and there was a large amount of lost signal alerts or technical issues during that period of time. So what kind of things can cause, for instance, a signal saying that the offender is tampering with their ankle bracelet and they're not, or that it's been disconnected?
Mm-hmm. So with the instance of tampering, a lot of times what we've seen is these devices, which aren't regularly replaced by the Department of Corrections, can end up just wearing out. And then there's a band that is supposed to detect any tampering. And sometimes just with age, it will start shorting out and telling the Department of Corrections that the offender is tampering with it. And upon several inspections in records that we've been provided from police departments, these police officers have noted that there's no evidence of tampering, but rather that, this has to be a technical malfunction.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that sometimes it shows up that the unit is not sending the information, it's either because of a bad battery or because we've all been in places where cell reception is really bad, and it's the same technology, right?
Yeah, that's a huge problem for offenders I've talked to in northern Wisconsin, where cell reception is especially weak. They go out to try to, go meet with friends at a cafe or something, and then they get called multiple times by the Department of Corrections saying, you've lost a signal, or they'll even be at their home, and they'll get these calls telling them to step outside in a thunderstorm, for instance. That's what one offender told me. And they'll call and call and call until they can finally, get the confirmation that they are, in fact, located in their home.
I think we should add, too, about satellite is the other way that the other technology that's in play here, and anybody who has used a GPS knows that they're actually made to be outside, right? Mm-hmm. And so people who are inside can end up losing satellite signals, and it'll make it look as though they're not at home where they're supposed to be, or they're not at their job or whatever. Right. And so that's another thing that can go wrong.
Mm-hmm. And Dee, what do we know about how much this GPS tracking program costs the state on an annual basis?
that's about $9.7 million a year, but that does not include the costs of jailing offenders, either correctly or incorrectly, depending on whether you believe they have false alerts. But that is the cost of the monitoring center as well as the devices themselves.
And this is something that's actually increased in the last several years, isn't it?
Yeah, we've actually doubled the number of offenders. 5 years ago, we looked at the same issue, and we identified some of these same problems, and there was a little bit of talk in the legislature that they were going to do something about it. They haven't. We asked for any records, any audits, any reports where they'd analyzed the accuracy and the effectiveness of the technology, and they were unable to provide us any records that showed that they had actually looked at that. So that was 5 years ago. Here it is 5 years later. Some of the same problems are still cropping up, and the size of the program has doubled.
We're talking with Riley Vedderkind and Dee Hall from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism about a piece called Losing Track that looks into the state's GPS monitoring of criminal offenders. And Riley, one of the things that people point to with the GPS tracking system is that it lets offenders out of incarceration and gets them reintegrated into society. But the reality for a lot of these offenders is not that they're able to successfully reintegrate. What are some of the challenges that these problems with the system pose for them?
Well, the problem when offenders get out, you know, you'd think that a lot of them would, and many of them are certainly happy to be out of jail eventually, but what many of them have told me is that because of the unpredictability of this system, because at any moment the police could show up at their door due to something that's, you know, likely not their fault and take them back to jail, that's really jarring. You know, I had one offender who is really trying his best, he lives in Madison here, really trying his best to be involved in the community. He just was hired as a peer support specialist at EMUM in Madison. He told me that it's been so hard on his family to always have to never know when he could be taken back. I mean, with so many violations, you know, there's always a chance that his parole could be revoked and he could be sent back to jail, and it's, you know, really not up to him to have any say in that. So the unpredictability is really tough for these offenders who are just trying to integrate back into the community.
And I should say, too, when we looked at just that 1 month of data, we did it because there were so many alerts that go off every single month. But just in the month of May, this past May, there were 56,853 alerts for 895 offenders for lost cell service. That's an average of 64 times for each of these offenders. Now, they didn't call each of them each time, but there is a chance that if they cannot regain cell signal from these offenders, if they can't reach them, which they try to call them on the cell phone or a landline, the Department of Corrections can take them into custody for up to 3 days until they figure out what happened. So that is what Riley's talking about. And then for people who are still on probation or parole, this could be considered a violation of that, and they could have to serve the rest of their sentence in prison.
So, Dee, how does the state ultimately measure success of this program? Do they have benchmarks, and are they meeting them?
We are not aware of any benchmarks. They've not given us any. I think the ultimate goal is they feel like the public is safer knowing where these offenders are, and that is their goal. And I guess our story just raises questions about at what cost, and is it really helping any of these offenders reintegrate?
And Riley, you spoke with several criminal justice experts that study GPS tracking systems like this. What do they have to say about whether the data shows that they are worth the cost or not?
So studies on the effectiveness of GPS, especially in reducing recidivism rates, is especially mixed. What researchers have found, and a lot of research was being done on this between 2010 and 2015, when these systems were being rolled out a lot more. What they're telling me is that recidivism does decline slightly, but only for administrative violations. So that's instances of reporting the address at which you live, you know, keeping your personal information updated in the system. Very minor things like that really don't have too much to do with more severe instances of actual criminal reoffending.
And I think it's fair to say, too, that there's been a common thought, wisdom, that sex offenders are more likely to reoffend, that they're incorrigible, that they cannot be rehabilitated. And the studies show that that's actually not particularly true. They're no more and sometimes less likely to reoffend than other offenders. And so keeping them away from parks and schools seems like a really good idea, but it's not necessarily addressing the issue. If they are to reoffend, statistics show that it would most likely be a child or an individual whom they already know.
And many people have told me, you know, in the police community, that by the time, you know, alert would go off, or if an offender was in a public park, the crime would likely be committed by the time that the police showed up, because, you know, a police response in some rural counties could be up to an hour in Marinette County, for instance, where everything is just so spread apart.
And Dee, as we wrap up, as you mentioned earlier, the center looked at this 5 years ago, and there was hope that maybe this information would lead to some changes in the system. And you said that nothing really happened then. Are there hopes now? Is there anyone, for instance, in the legislature who might be a champion for this?
It's really hard to say. I mean, there's almost no public sympathy for sex offenders except among sex offenders and their families. And so it is not a cause that most people take up willingly as a political issue. So I really don't know. I think we have heard from some offenders that whom we talked to 5 years ago, that for them, some of the technical issues have gotten ironed out and they have not been thrown in jail quite as often. So that's a hopeful sign that maybe the technology is getting better. It seems to be getting better. But in terms of somebody championing it, I don't know if that will actually happen.
Well, Riley, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dee, always a pleasure.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Dee Hall is managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And Riley Vetterkind was formerly with the center. He's now a reporter for WisPolitics.com. They talked to Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson about Losing Track, a series looking into the state's GPS monitoring of criminal offenders. First, the University of Wisconsin-Superior announced last fall that it would cut 24 majors and minors and one graduate program at the school. The move surprised students and faculty at UW-Superior and led to protests from students and claims from faculty that they were not consulted by the administration. Now, new emails show that UW-Superior provost may have violated the school's shared governance provision with that decision. Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She's based in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, give us an explanation of this concept here, shared governance, before we go into the details. What is it?
So shared governance is basically the idea that chancellors, along with faculty and staff, work together in setting things like designing curriculum and degree requirements, things like determining academic standards and establishing grading. They work together in order to identify areas that, you know, they might need to address so that they can basically build this all in a way that works for the institution.
And with this cancellation of 20-plus programs, what's the allegation here? What are people saying Provost did wrong when it comes to these shared governance rules?
Well, I guess what they're saying is that they ignored shared governance as they went about this decision. There are emails that the American Federation of Teachers in Wisconsin obtained through an open records request, and it basically shows the behind-the-scenes thinking and thought process as to how they were looking at programs and how they wanted to portray how they were going to suspend them. So they knew that they wanted to stop offering these programs after a certain period of time, but they weren't actively consulting with a faculty senate, and I don't believe they were also consulting with academic staff as well. So that's the problem that people here have on campus, is that these emails seem to show that they deliberately avoided talking with faculty and staff.
And it, if I recall correctly, there was one email, I think, to a UW system lawyer bringing this up, and the lawyer said, yeah, you're probably violating shared governance, right? And they didn't run with that? Do I have that right?
Yeah, so the provost, Jackie Weisenberger, reached out to UW system legal counsel the day before they made the announcement that they were suspending these 25 programs. And so they essentially reached out and said, hey, it was my impression that our chancellor could make that call without governance approval if we were not intending to issue layoffs or terminate faculty or instructional academic staff. So basically, they wanted to make sure that they were on solid footing legally before they announced to department chairs the next morning how they were going to go. So they basically wanted to say, do we have approval under state statutes to be able to make these decisions without faculty or staff approval? And they do. They do have, the chancellor does have the final say in what can happen. But in the statute, it says that the chancellors are supposed to be going about all of these things that I mentioned before, like designing curriculum, in consultation with faculty. So as the statutes read right now, that language suggests that they should be consulting as they go about these decision-making processes. So the teachers' union here on campus feels that those rules were violated.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter in Superior, looking at UW-Superior, big cuts they made to programs there and accusations from faculty and staff that they weren't consulted and should have been consulted in the process. And Danny, I understand UW-Superior says, there was an older process that kind of fit the bill here. What are they pointing toward?
An older process that fit the bill?
They had gone through, when they had done previous cuts, they'd kind of prioritized programs.
Oh, yes. So, yeah, they had gone through a process called program prioritization prior to making this decision. So they have said, the administration here on campus has said, that they did consult with faculty and staff all along in what programs may, need addressing and which ones should be removed from that list and kept and, maybe invest a little bit more in. A couple of years ago, the former provost, Faith Hensrud, released a list of the 26 programs that were still under review, and 10 had been removed from that. So that meant that there were 16 programs that were still under review. So you go from 16 programs that were under review to 25 that were suspended. So I'm just doing the math here. It looks like there were 9 programs that came from somewhere else besides that consultation process with faculty and staff.
So faculty and staff are unhappy that, as they see it, shared governance didn't happen here. These new emails are out. They're pointing to that. Are they looking for anything to change now? Is there any thought that these programs would be uncut now?
I don't think there is hope that the programs will be removed from this suspension list. I think, as Deborah Augsburger, the faculty union president here on campus, put it, the horse is already out of the barn. To them, it speaks more to an issue of trust and respect between administration and faculty and staff on campus. It's been a very difficult several years for the university financially and with the loss of faculty and staff. People are just having a really hard time. This feels like one more blow.
And Danny, can you talk about the role that the campus, UW-Superior campus, plays in the Superior area? How important a part of the community is it?
Well, I mean, it's a very large employer here in the city of Superior. It's a very rural area. It's the only 4-year public university in northern Wisconsin. I believe the next closest 4-year public university would be either UW-Eau Claire or Stevens Point. So it's a pretty important part of northern Wisconsin. It serves a lot of underserved communities, and it has a lot of people who are low income that turn to this school. So it's a kind of a critical part of the community.
How about the students who are in these programs that were cut? Are they able to at least finish out their education under the major
Yes.
they adopted?
Yeah, they are. They will be able to finish their degree. And then there's this 5-year window where these programs could be reinstated. So, faculty and staff are continuing to work with administration, or at least that's what administration says. Chancellor Renee Walker didn't to return my request for an interview, but she said that faculty governments will be involved in exploring and identifying new programs or existing programs to invest in so that they can meet the needs of the region, and that she remains dedicated to the success of the institution and the students.
Danny, you mentioned budget problems, longer-term problems for UW-Superior. Is there a sense that, okay, after this latest round of cuts, they might be out of the woods?
Well, there's a $2.5 million deficit that remains here on campus. To my knowledge, that was the last number that was out there. And, you know, now with funding at the state level being tied to student success, I feel that they are making these decisions because there's more pressure financially on the institution to show that they're meeting these requirements, that they are getting people to degree as quick as they can and getting them into the workforce, because future funding might hinge on that.
Danny, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She's based in Superior. She joined us to talk about a UW-Superior decision to suspend 25 programs at the university. That's last year. And new questions about whether they followed UW system rules in the process. You're hearing the sounds of a recent protest calling for tighter gun restrictions following the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. From the Vietnam era to Occupy Wall Street to Black Lives Matter and the protest you just heard, young people have often played pivotal roles in social movements. Our next guest is an expert on social protests and the impact they have on our everyday politics. David Meyer is professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. He blogs at Politics Outdoors. David, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be with you, Rob.
David, before we dig back into the history, this seems like a unique moment, at least in the gun debate in the United States. What do you make of the high school students being involved in these gun-related protests?
Well, I'm totally impressed and awed by the commitment of the Parkland kids and their ability to command national attention and try to keep it focused on gun issues. I'm also impressed with their ability not to immediately fall into partisan politics. So that's all very exciting. But as you know, we've seen lots of moments of activism that follow dramatic mass shootings, and then sometimes mostly nothing happens.
Now, looking back, how often have we seen young people play important roles in American protest movements?
Young people are often kind of the front lines of doing activism, though they don't always get credit for it. Actually, one of the reasons I like teaching college is when you're a young person, you view things with a moral clarity and sharpness and see yourself as acting with urgency to change the world. I mean, I've had students come up to me and say, the way I think about everything has changed after this quarter. And it's not because of my teaching, it's because of where they are in their lives. Everything seems to be open. And they are unlikely to be patient with the idea that, well, you know, the gun issue or the civil rights issue or the women's issue or the peace issue just takes time and we have to be patient to get things done. So young people were on the front lines of the civil rights movement, leading the bus boycotts in Montgomery, organizing the lunch counter sit-ins. They were on the front lines of the Chicano movement in California, leading student walkouts for educational equality. They were on the front lines of the anti-war movement because they said, we're the people who are going to be drafted. And there were protests in high school and at colleges across the country.
Now, with the post-Parkland protests, and I imagine it's happened before, a question has been raised, especially by people who disagree with the goals of the movement. Well, should we be listening to younger people? Are they politically sophisticated enough to have opinions we should be paying attention to? Is this something we run across again and again through youth protests in history?
Absolutely, but it's not even just youth protests. Whenever there are any kind of mass movements, the job of the opposition is to come up with ways why you shouldn't take those people seriously. So the people who are protesting and articulate are either very naive and therefore not to be taken seriously, and that's not just students. That could be mothers. That could be regular citizens. That could be environmentalists. Or they're dupes. They're controlled by special interests, or they're controlled by foreign powers. So seeing these kids, seeing gun interests trying to discredit these kids is really predictable. The thing I'd add, if you work with high school students or American teens, the kids who are coming out of Parkland are great. They're smart. They're sharp. They're committed. But they're not unique. There are lots of kids like that all across the United States.
Talking to David Meyer, professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine, looking at youth and protest in the United States, especially after the shootings in Parkland, Florida. We asked people online, have you ever been part of a youth protest? You can answer that question on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kirsta on Facebook says no, but she fully supports it, youth protest, because it will help youth get more involved in the political system. David, is that true? Are young people who start off maybe organizing a protest campaign then people who are going to be involved in politics, local, national, down the road?
Usually that's the way it works. Usually wherever you start, whenever you start, you keep going. You may not be doing exactly the same things. The kids who are organizing a demonstration now, they might not be organizing demonstrations in 6 or 8 or 10 years, but they may be running for office or endorsing candidates or lobbying. That's the common pattern. You know, a classic example who's a hero that we should, talk about whenever we have the chance is John Lewis, who started as a divinity student, a college student in Nashville, and got arrested over and over again, got beaten over and over again, an extraordinarily brave man. And he's a member of Congress now, and he still sometimes gets arrested.
But is there something different that makes it challenging to make that transition? If you're out protesting, you have, as you're saying earlier, that moral clarity on an issue. As you go into politics, you may have to compromise to get elected, to get reelected, to get something passed. Do we lose something in that transition that takes a lot of people out of politics?
I'm not sure it takes people out of politics. It may take people out of protest on a routine basis. When we look at people's participation in politics over the life course, there's a lot of variability in what people do at different times. The kids who are protesting now in 10 years or 15 years may be voting and contributing money and worried about raising families. And in 30 years, they may be doing protests again. It sort of depends on how your life develops. And do we lose something? Everybody loses something when they're not an adolescent anymore. There's something really exciting about the way everything feels and how intensely clearly you can see everything and how you can maintain a focus. And most people don't do that their whole lives.
I want to give a listen to one of the Parkland students. Emma Gonzalez is one of the many students who spoke at a rally after the shooting. She's gotten a high profile since. Here she is.
I watched an interview this morning and noticed that one of the questions was, do you think your children will have to go through other school shooter drills? And our response is that our neighbors will not have to go through other school shooter drills when we have had our say with the government. And maybe the adults have gotten used to saying it is what it is. But if us students have learned anything, it's that if you don't study, you will fail. And in this case, if you actively do nothing, people continually end up dead. So it's time to start doing.
So what do you make of Emma Gonzalez and David Hogg and the other people who have emerged as the faces and voices of this protest movement?
I'm in awe of Emma Gonzalez. She's a charismatic, and she took AP U.S. government, so she knows politics, too. And she appeared in school plays, so she knows how to do the drama stuff and how to organizer speaking. Another boy, Cameron Kasky, is also a drama kid. David Hogg is a campus high school journalist, and he can write. And again, these kids are great. They're tremendous, but it's not just those three. Jacqueline Corin has been posting videos on her Twitter feed, and they're really powerful. A girl named Sarah Chadwick has been trolling conservative figures on Twitter and, you know, throwing facts in their face. And, I mean, these are the kids that I've heard about from across the country. There are lots and lots of kids with this capacity, and I think we want to appreciate, you know, like, what they're putting up and all it takes. But Emma's a really powerful speaker. I mean, imagine what she'll be able to do when she's 19 or 20.
Is there something about a younger person in whatever era we're talking about being the one that's most in touch with the newest method of communication? In this case, we've got the digital natives having maybe a built-in command of what how to communicate on social media?
I don't know if this is a pattern of the past, but it's something that really matters now. Today's teens grew up in a social media era. They're more conversant on Twitter and more clever about how to use it than adults who spent time trying to strategize it academically. And I think that the nature of social media has made it possible for them to define themselves and their issues to a much larger degree than earlier youth movements. So the peace movement of the 1960s was subsumed into the student protests were subsumed into a larger anti-Vietnam movement. The civil rights movement, where young people were on the front lines, was still largely articulated by older leaders of established organizations. But these kids can get out from underneath the big organizations and get their own message out. Another piece of that, Rob, is that student activists and all kinds of activists of the past used to be dependent upon getting their message through mainstream media. And they were dependent upon who reporters chose to interview, who reporters chose to quote. But these kids can put their own words out front and circulate speeches like Emma Gonzalez's video that might not make it through an editorial process at the New York Times. So that's a new development, and I'm excited about watching it.
David Meyer is with us, professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. He's here to talk about the history and present of youth protests. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of recent protests following the school shooting in Florida? What impact do you think young people have on politics and social change? Should people pay attention to teens and young adults when they speak out on issues? Should the media pay attention to them? And if you yourself are a teen who takes part in protests or did back when you were a teen, what can we learn from these efforts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about youth protests. David Meyer is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. He blogs about social and political demonstrations at Politics Outdoors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on youth protests, their involvement in politics, the current wave of protests led by survivors of the shooting in Florida? And if you are young yourself now, what are some social issues you've worked for or against? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Gary is with us in Fitchburg. Gary, hi.
Hi. I'm someone that marched against the Vietnam War, marched also against the Iraq War. I'm 71. I'm wondering where the youth of today are protesting the various wars we're in around the world, and I think we're like bombing something like 9 countries, and perhaps The reason is it's not on the regular news. And today's youth are involved in protesting monuments, Confederate monuments, and other things. But the problems in our country, many of them are because the wealth is being pulled out, sucked out by the Pentagon.
Gary, thanks for the call. So Gary's saying, David, okay, young people are involved in issues inward looking, though, maybe not looking at the global picture and underlying issues.
I think young people are involved in some global issues. I think I've seen more action on climate change than on war. And I think part of the reason is, as Gary suggested, the American participation in military action abroad gets much less coverage than it could. And unlike the unlike America up until 1973, young men are not liable to the draft. So the kids at Parkland can be concerned with lots and lots of threats, like the like a school shooter, like the climate, like spending on schools, like being able to afford college. But war is probably not highest on the list most of the time.
Thanks a lot for that call. There's been some criticism of the amount of attention paid to these students after young people involved in the Black Lives Matter movement didn't seem to get that much attention, and not as individuals speaking out for their movement. What do you make of the – do you see that difference? What do you make of it?
It sure looks like that's true. And I think that part of the story is – the media that pick up on movements are concerned with their own audiences, and the mostly white, mostly middle class, well educated kids are more telegenic and interesting to their audiences than, you know, children and young people of color who are protesting against police violence. The suburban TV watchers or newspaper readers are not particularly concerned on a day-to-day basis, if they're white, with police violence because they don't see it as a threat to themselves or their kids. That's not true about the school shootings. Is it unfair? Is it asymmetrical? Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Talking to David Meyer from the University of California, Irvine, looking at youth protest and politics. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Melissa is with us in Black River Falls. Melissa, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
I think it's always great when we get students engaged in the political systems early to learn how the systems work and things like that. I have participated in different events, you know, in the 80s when I was a student and things. And what I've come to realize now that I'm pushing 50 is that there's a lot of things that I did not understand about the world as a whole and the global view of things and how systems work together and how specifically, like you're talking about, the gun violence and the shootings and different aspects, things are not as easy and as straightforward as some students may understand. And so it always needs to be taken into context about, yes, you know, the safety is extremely important. And as parents and adults that are listening to their demonstrations, we need to take that into context and be able to express to them the bigger global picture and view and how things play together in order to be successful with this. Because if we just look at it from the eyes of a teenager, you're going to leave out a lot of information that's critical to me making decisions and policies, and we need to not do it from a knee-jerk reaction.
Melissa, thanks for the call. David, what do you think?
I think that Melissa's comment is pretty astute. The flip side of that point, though, about things being more complicated, is that the kids are comfortable bringing up things that are obvious until you've been doing lots and lots of research. So one of the boys who went to the meeting with Trump talked about Australia, where I assume there's as much mental illness as there is in the United States, but there aren't mass shootings because people don't have access to guns. And if you're doing gun activism or advocacy all the time in the United States, that's a basic
you know, situation. That's a basic set of conditions that you may neglect to bring up because you've long ago learned to deal with it. And so I think that there's a balance between experience and the urgency of youth.
David, as we start to wrap up, what makes the difference in success? What makes a protest successful in enacting change versus one that just sort of fizzles?
I would point to two big things. One is being able to sustain the effort over time. The American system is set up to make political change very, very, very difficult and slow. And what these kids on guns are trying to do is set up a series of actions that are going to continue through the 2018 elections and beyond. They're going to have to be able to do that to make a big impact. The second thing that matters is mobilizing broad constituencies, people who don't necessarily agree with you on lots of other stuff, to work on your issues and to accept the diversity within a social movement, a diversity of tactics. So people are going to file a legal challenge, others are going to work in elections, others are going to organize demonstrations, and a diversity of claims, like things that people care about. And the Parkland kids seem really sophisticated in understanding this. But following through and maintaining the effort is going to take not only their good smarts and good intentions, but also the support and activism of well-established groups that are led by adults.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Rob. Take care.
We've been talking to David Meyer. He's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. His blog looking at social movements is called Politics Outdoors. He was with us today to talk about youth protests, past and present, and the impact they have on social change, politics, and more, especially in the aftermath of the Parkland, Florida mass shooting and the student efforts for gun control since then. You can keep the conversation going. We've got a question up at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you ever been part of a youth protest? Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can like us there and tell us about your past or present involved in youth protest.